ready to show up here hopefully momentarily. But I'd like to get started on time on a Monday morning. This morning we have some invited testimony. We have Metro Councilor Carl Hostica to come and talk to us about a little congestion, transportation congestion issue in the Portland metro area. Metro did a study, and Carl has some information he'd like to share with us. I think it's important for the committee as we talk about alternatives to the gas tax when we fund our transportation system. That's one of the major topics of this session as we talk about transportation. With that, I'd like to invite Carl Hostica, Doug, are you going to be in Doug Riggs on floor and chat with us for a few minutes?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Doug Riggs with PacWest Communications. We, as you, I think most of you know, represent Metro here in Salem during the session, and we've met with many of you over the last few months. We've had several of you actually come to Metro, Representative Zahner, Representative Starr, Representative Rosenbaum. We appreciate very much your interest and support. Representative Hostica served here for tonight. Councilor Hostica now, former Representative Hostica, served in Salem from 1983 to 1993, I think that's right, six terms, so we have some experience here. What I've handed out is kind of our standard Metro packet. You'll see this purple packet that'll kind of give you an idea of the variety of things that Metro does, and also the traffic relief newsletter, which I think Councilor Hostica will get into. But again, thank you for having us here.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carl Hostica. I'm a Metro Councilor representing parts of Washington County and Clackamas County. And as Mr. Riggs said, I'm a battle-scarred veteran of the transportation finance wars. During my term, we actually passed three measures in the legislature that were not referred to the people, fortunately, and withstood the test of time. But as a result of that, during 1998-1999, I was the chair of a committee that was sponsored by Metro, funded by the Federal Highway Administration, and also participation from the Oregon Department of Transportation to study peak period pricing as a method of both managing demand and financing transportation improvements. And so what I'd like to do is spend a few minutes this morning sort of summarizing the results of that study and then answering any questions. This is primarily as we look for new and innovative ways to fund our transportation system. I'm going to be sort of speaking from this document here, but I'm skipping back and forth, so I don't know if you can read along directly. As I said, the study was funded by the Federal Highway Administration through a grant both to the Oregon Department of Transportation and to Metro, and it was conducted by Metro staff but overseen by a task force. And if you look in the back page, you can see the membership of that task force, which included some members of this body, Senator Ken Baker and Representative Rasmussen, who were members of this body at the time, but also a number of leading business people from the Portland metropolitan area, including Betty Atterbury from the Westside Economic Alliance, Steve Clark, who publishes the community newspapers, John Egge, Mike Salzgiver of Intel, Robert Scanlon, who's a well-known commercial real estate developer. They were all on this committee. So this idea has been looked at from a variety of perspectives, and the conclusions, which I'll report at the end, were agreed to by all members of the committee. First thing is a peak period pricing, or we use that term rather than congestion pricing, because the concept is to put tolls or pricing on highway facilities based upon the time of day. And this is used in a number of different places. The concept is used all throughout our economy in telecommunications, in airlines, and electricity pricing, for example. Even theaters have pricing based upon time of day, and number of people participating. But as far as it's applied to transportation, it's been used throughout this country already. In Orange County, there's a private facility known as SR-91, which is was built by a private company and has tolls that vary from 25 cents to $3.50, depending on the time of day. In San Diego and in Houston, Texas, they've instituted what are called hot lanes, which are either HOV lanes, where a person who wanted to travel on that lane in a single occupancy vehicle could do so by paying a toll. And so that there's tolling, and that's also time of day dependent. And then it's being used throughout the world in Toronto, Canada, and Singapore, in Norway, and a number of places. And just briefly, the technology of tolling is very advanced. And most of these places use small transponders that are placed on the in the windshield of a car, and then they pass under a reader as they go onto the facility. And you can either have people charge that transponder with money, similarly to a phone card, or you could have the reader read it and send you a bill. Either way, it's used in different ways throughout the world. But it's very advanced. You don't have to slow down. You don't have to have a pocket full of change or anything like that. So in our study, we looked at the Portland metro area to see if this was a useful way of proceeding. And we looked at, and this is now on page 2, a number of different ways that you could do tolling. The probably the most common way that many of us know about is tolling at a choke point in the transportation system, which would either be a bridge or a tunnel or something like that. You could have a toll facility there. The way it's done in other parts of the United States, as I said, in Houston, San Diego, and in Orange County, is single lanes in a multi-lane facility. One or two lanes are tolled, whereas the other lanes are free for people who want to use them. You could also toll an entire highway. You could toll a whole corridor, or as they do actually in Norway, is they toll a section of town, where if you want to go into central Oslo or Trondheim or something like that, you pay a toll as you get into the central city. So we looked at all of those options for the Portland metro area and looked at a number of different facilities. What I'd like to do then is talk about the criteria we use to evaluate whether or not tolling would be a good idea. And that's in this part, which has the little map. But the first question is there enough revenue to make it worthwhile? And so you wanted to look at demand and the effect of tolling on demand. And in fact, what's been found whenever this has been tried is that more people use the facility than were previously estimated to use it, that the economists have consistently underestimated usage. And so revenue has actually been higher in most cases than people expected. But then you want to look at the impact on individuals as to whether they are gaining a benefit. In other words, the benefit of increased certainty or time saved is outweighed by the toll. You want to look at the effect of tolling on neighborhood streets or parallel arterials, whether you drive people off the road into the neighborhoods. Of course, what we found is congestion drives people off into the neighborhoods. And anything you can do to relieve congestion actually improves that. We also wanted to look at equity questions. Is tolling, people talked about Lexus lanes and things like that, and so that there were concerns that this would create a premium service and that it wouldn't be fair to people. And then we looked at whether or not there were actually any savings in air quality or energy. And briefly, our findings were that in all the cases we looked at, which are on this map, in most, the benefits would outweigh the cost. And part of the question of benefits depends on what you do with the revenue. That the impact on local streets varies depending, first of all, on whether there are any, and that any local options to using the tolled facility, and that most of the options would reduce driving time for people and improve the travel situation for all income groups. Just one footnote on this Lexus lanes. What we found was that the people who use these facilities that are currently exist are people who want to get someplace and to know they can get there on time. there was talk of the mother who has to pay $5 a minute if they're late for daycare. If they pay $3 to take a toll facility, say 5 minutes, that's quite a saving for that person. Or somebody who has to punch a time clock, wants to get there. The main idea is certainty as much as saving time, if you can use a facility that's open and free-flowing. We also spend a lot of time talking with citizens and did a number of focus groups and some surveys about this concept and had a large number of open houses so that we had a large amount of citizen input into how this concept would work. And as you might guess, if you first ask somebody, do you want to pay a toll to go on the highway, their answer is going to be no. And we take that for granted. But then if you ask them, would you pay a toll in order to be able to get someplace on time, to save time, to have improved transportation opportunities, then they start to say yes under certain conditions. And those conditions are listed under the public input section here. The first condition is that people need to have choices, meaning that you can't make it so that they have to pay a toll for everything they do. But if you give them a choice to either go in a tolled lane, non-tolled lane, different kinds of transportation options, then they would like to have the opportunity to have the improved transportation opportunity and the tolled lanes. That adding capacity is preferable, that rather than use this concept on existing capacity, it's more likely to be acceptable if you do it on new capacity. And that people want to see it on those places where they're already experiencing congestion. Equity continues to be an issue, and so that there are various ways that have been looked at to either give rebates or relief to low-income people. And that how you use the revenue affects the support that you get. And in most cases, people would like to see the revenues generated by tolling invested right on the same facility that they're paying for. So our conclusion then was that the idea of tolling and peak period pricing should be considered anytime we build a new facility, both to help finance a facility and then help manage the demand on the facility once it's built. Because what we find is if you build a facility, make it free for everybody, open for all, it gets congested very quickly. But that we don't recommend any tolling on existing highways at this point. And that also we recommended, and this is partially because the federal government will help fund such a thing, that some sort of pilot project be developed within the next few years. There is federal funding available. Metro has adopted this as part of its regional transportation plan, and the Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation, I knew I could get it right, has said that we will consider using tolling whenever we build new facilities, and we're looking at things like the 99 to I-5 connector, Sunrise Corridor, new lanes on 26, new lanes on 217. Anytime you look at a major facility where people can get on and get off and make it worth their while, we thought we should look at tolling. And so also in closing, though, I'd just like to add a few of my personal perspectives here. This is not the committee's perspective, but it's my personal perspective about why I think this is a good option from a political point of view. And there are two features of using peak period pricing and tolling that I think make it attractive. The first one is that it's a local solution to a local problem. And one of the things that I know you've all experienced, because we all experience this every time we talk about transportation financing, it's does this part of the state pay while that part of the state benefits? Now, how do you allocate costs and benefits in the transportation financing system? Well, having tolling would say, here's a local financing mechanism and the revenues are applied to a local problem. It also embodies, as best as we can, the idea that user pays, that the need for new facilities, especially in the metropolitan area, are highly time dependent. Now, we don't need to build new highways in the metropolitan area to accommodate the traffic at 2 o'clock in the morning. for at even 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The new facilities are needed because of congestion that's caused at certain times of day. So if you can have a financing mechanism that says the person who causes the problem pays for the solution and is locally contained, I think it has a lot of political advantages. And so that's why I'm here this morning for providing information, but also urging you to give this concept favorable consideration and put it as part of the package for new transportation financing. In fact, I believe it was in the 99 session that a bill was passed authorizing this in the metropolitan area, but it hasn't been used yet. Anything that you can do to help move it forward, we'd appreciate. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony this morning. The one question that I have is, did the study show that as you modeled peak pricing, that the infrastructure that we currently have on the ground was more effectively utilized, I mean, that congestion
right.
was lessened?
Well, the question is, if you do it in conjunction with new construction, then obviously the answer is yes. And because what happens is the new construction provides new opportunities, which then frees up the old facilities. However, if you do it without new construction, the answer is also yes, because it tends to spread that demand out over time, that people who have options of traveling at different times will take those options. And that's been found everywhere it's been tried.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Ventura.
Would you have some discussion about sunset clauses, or did you have any at the committee level?
Well, I think that there was discussion about the idea that in many cases tolling has been done, and once a facility is paid for, the tolls are taken off, if that's what you mean by a sunset clause. I think we didn't think that that was necessarily a good idea, because once you take the toll off, the usage would go up and you'd create a demand for a new facility, so that probably the best way to do it would be to maintain a tolling structure and then use the money for maintenance or for construction of compatible transportation facilities. But that's certainly something that the committee could consider. I mean, it's your option to do what you like on that.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it Mr. Rex?
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Hostica?
Mm-hmm.
How do you get to be your pilot project? I would like to offer up Yamhill County and 99 Dutch.
Well, actually, I think Mr. Hart is here also from Metro, who might be able to answer that question if it's a serious question.
It is the most serious question I'll ask probably this session. Yes. Oh, Mr. Chair, sorry.
I'd like to introduce Bridget Wehard, who is the chief staff person for the committee and who's continuing to work with us.
Great. Well, we are still looking for, as when the recommendations of the committee were adopted by JPAC, they also adopted the idea of a pilot project within 2 years, and what we've been instructed to do as staff is to, as we're doing corridor studies, looking at expansion of highway capacity, such as the facility you're suggesting, we are looking at peak period pricing as one of the options every time. So right now I understand that there is going to be, I think ODOT is doing some additional work on that facility, looking at studying routing or something in the next couple of years, so we can certainly consider that.
But the federal government does have money for pilot projects.
They do have money for pilot projects. The one thing about peak period pricing to keep in mind, and I don't want to, I'm happy to have someone who's interested in having their facility priced, but is that congestion is kind of key to the revenues. So that has been a factor in for example, some of the facilities that are a little further on the urban edge may not have enough demand to make it worthwhile, although I think ODOT did look at that, so we can certainly consider it.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up, please? Congestion, we can certainly take care of. Yes, I believe we are number one in congestion in the state, and I believe Representative Zahner will
stand up and vouch for me, and probably even Representative Brown, because we all touch Yamhill County, and we're this is very important to us. It's causing great economic damage to our community, and we have a vast number of commuters who really need to, you know, get to where they can make a decent, maybe possibly someday, a homeowner wage job.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, they are really suffering in the area of adequate wages to take care of their families. So I really very much would appreciate having an opportunity to bring our whole Yamhill County, mm-hmm. we call it the carcass. There are two senators and three other representatives who touch Yamhill County, and we'd like very much to come together with you and further discuss this. And I do have a concern, a serious concern on your issue of how low-income individuals pay for the service. I you know, while I believe in user fees, I'm concerned. And with our senior citizens, you know, greatly impacted. But, you know, principally those who are commuting every day of their lives have to go through this process, need the efficiency, but can't afford it. And I'm wondering how this is addressed.
Well, it's possible a number of ways. Probably the easiest way to do would be to provide people with transponders that could just automatically let them go through, depending on whether they meet certain criteria or not. And so that once you have the transponder, it's very easy to program what happens once it's read, so that you could say if you had a certain income level that you could travel, but you wouldn't be billed. Technically, it's not a problem. It depends on how the committee or somebody wants to structure the pricing arrangements.
Thank you very much.
President Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hostica, or whomever would like to respond. In terms of technology and the technology you've described in terms of one of these pilot projects, what is normally termed an acceptable level of cost of administration in the sense of obviously you're trying to generate revenues to do whatever improvement that you've mm-hmm. done, but what's an acceptable cost of administration in terms of collecting fees?
I don't have a percentage off the top of my head, but we did look at operational costs and construction mm-hmm. costs, and what our criteria was basically they had to be self-supporting in terms of the operations at least, and then the idea was, well, how much more could they generate since we were primarily the recommendation was to look at new capacity, how much more could they generate beyond mm-hmm. For the new capacity. So all of them were self-supporting in terms of the operations, and I can get you know, the ratio of revenues to cost, if you're interested.
I think that some evidence is that in California they're making a profit on the deal. So, and what they do there is they actually sell the transponders to people. So it depends, again, how you structure your costs and your revenues, depending on how you would then price administration, but it's very minimal. I think it's
in the scheme of
single digits.
Exactly. I mean, in terms of whether they're going to completely pay for the new cost of construction, which was sort of the discussion we were having a few minutes ago, what we found was that most of them wouldn't pay 100% if you're only pricing new construction, unless it's an absolute bottleneck, like a, you know, a bridge, something like that, where there's no other choice. So they would cover their operational costs, but maybe only cover 30 or 40%, depending on how congested it is, of the total new construction costs.
Mr. Chairman, follow up.
Yes.
In terms of prospective fees, say, for instance, take 217, where you might add a lane in each direction, and it's probably one of the most congested 5-mile-long freeways in the state, about 5 miles. What would be a prospective cost for that, for peak hour, for a driver, 250 or so?
Yeah, actually, the number would depend upon the amount of congestion, but our original figure was 15 cents a mile would be where you would start. What happened, like I said, in every time this has been tried, the limit on what people are willing to pay is a political limit, that they haven't been able to price people off the roads. Do you understand what I'm saying here? They keep charging, they keep raising the prices, and people keep paying. So that it's essentially a political limit that says we're unwilling to go beyond a number, but we said the base level would be about 15 cents a mile and it would cover all the costs and to make it worthwhile.
Mr. Chairman, final follow-up. In terms of those studies and, well, political limit versus a reality limit in terms of, there would be a point at which, though, that fewer drivers would use the facility. They might stay in the three congested lanes, and you would end up losing money.
Well, that's what I'm saying is that's theoretically possible, but it hasn't happened. And when I'm saying a political limit, the example was in San Diego, where they were selling the opportunity to get on the HOV lane, to make it a hot lane. What happened was that they figured how many people they thought could go down there. They priced it, I think it was $35 a month or something like that. It was a very low price. They sold all they could. They said, okay, we still haven't controlled congestion. We're going to raise the price to $75 a month. They still sold all they could. Then they said $125. At that point, the political leadership stepped in and said, wait a minute, you know, this is going beyond what's reasonable here. So there wasn't an economic limit. The same thing in California. They started at $2.50 peak period toll for the SR-91, which I believe is about 12 miles, 10 to 12 miles long. It's now $3.75. It's still at capacity, so that they haven't found a way to get the price high enough. That's what I mean, to actually use the price as a way of kicking people off. And so that's why I'm saying is there's the economic limit, the market limit hasn't been found yet, but for reasons of equity, fairness, whatever, people have said we're going to set ceilings on these things.
Although I'd like to add to that we did take note of the fact that that's in California and some of the most congested facilities in the country, and in our analysis we didn't find, but they were just projections, you see, that we didn't find people willing to pay, you know, $4, $8 or whatever for a 10-mile stretch. But I think what Carl is getting at is that over time, as congestion builds, you will start, you know, moving pretty quickly up from that, say, 15 cents a mile to 30 cents a mile, which is what they were at in California.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if I could just give a little personal anecdote here. In a past life, I worked for Congressman Chris Cox, who represented the area in which SR-91 is located. And at the time, in the late 80s, early 1990s, his constituency was fairly well split. And the opponents of SR-91, at the time known as the Orange County Connector, made two points. Number one, they made the point about people in the lower incomes and the seniors not being able to afford or being interested in participating, and so they called it Lexus Lanes. The second point they made is that even if you had money, you wouldn't take it, because who would pay for a road when they could sit in traffic on some other road for free? And the opponents turned out to be wrong in both cases. As has been mentioned earlier, it's been an incredibly popular route. It was a new set of lanes that was constructed by a private company, but even those people who are at the lower income levels find that it's more economically viable for them to get someplace in 15 minutes and make an extra hour worth of work than it is for them to sit in traffic for an hour and a half, which is common in Orange County. So it's turned out to be politically a very popular thing. As Councillor Hostica mentioned, when you mention toll roads, initially people's reaction is very negative. The actual experience that most people have had once they're built has been very positive.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the presentation, and there's obviously a lot of food for thought here. I have a more global question for anybody that would care to answer it. We've heard a lot in this committee about the crisis in the overall funding of transportation in this state, and it strikes me that there could be some aspect of this that's sort of like the local option versus the school funding problem. So what I would like to hear is just your thoughts on how projects like this fit into working toward a long-term solution to the way we fund transportation in Oregon. Do you see it as a piece of it, or is there a danger that, you know, somebody could say, well, Portland can just deal with Portland's problems, and, you know, east of the mountains will deal with theirs. And
well, I see it as a very important part, and because it's almost the other side, it's been my experience, again, this political statement, that the division between the Portland metropolitan area and the rest of the state is the rock that sunk the ship of innumerable transportation funding proposals. So if we can find a way to navigate around that, then I think that we could be a lot more successful as a state as a whole. And then if you add on to that the issue that most of the time the major high-cost facilities that we're talking about in the Portland metro area are time of day dependent, then I think if you can even hone a little closer in on those specific ones and sort of take them off the list, I'll put them over here and say they're taken care of, then I think we could probably have a lot easier time and a more sort of compatible and friendly discussion about the needs of the state as a whole. That's my own feeling, based upon now almost 15 years of doing this.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask for your thoughts about a proposal that is circulating in Portland that disconnects the cost of roads from the use of the roads by placing a $2 surcharge on water and sewer bills, so it becomes sort of a form of property tax. One pays this regardless of whether one has a car or uses the roads, and there's no correlation how much one uses the roads. Do you have thoughts as to whether this goes exactly against the direction you're encouraging us to go in this model?
Let's see, how long is that rope that he just handed me? I would say from a theoretical policy perspective that it does disconnect usage from paying, and that's probably not a good direction to proceed.
Mr. Chairman,
follow up, Mr. Chair. Would you like to expand your answer?
No.
Mr. Chairman, if I might comment, coming from a jurisdiction that has imposed such a fee since the mid-1980s, due to the imposition of that fee, we have very well-maintained roads. The average cost for a single-family household is less than $2. It is a very economic way to collect the fee. I think it's a misnomer to think that automobile drivers are the only one that use roads. Bicyclists use roads. Pedestrians use roads in terms of using the sidewalks that are adjacent to roads. People who use public transit use roads. So I think it's in some cases I wish other jurisdictions would copy one of my jurisdiction's early and probably far-sighted decisions.
I would say that the only thing I would comment on is I hope that they are allowed to choose for themselves whether they do it.
Mr. Chair, follow up. Amen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Very good information. It would be helpful to us as we kind of change the conversation about transportation.
Thank you.
With that, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2562. Committee, I intend to listen to the testimony on this bill. There's some controversy about this bill. I don't intend to move the bill today. I'd like to 2562. I'd like to make sure that we try to get everybody on board before we move this bill. There's some work that needs to be done, I think. With that, we'd like to ask Doug Kramer and Gene Wilkinson to come forward, talk about the problem we have here.
Good morning. Chairman Starr, members of the committee, my name is Jean Underhill Wilkinson, and I am an associate director for governmental affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. I've been, I think this is my second time before you this session. We are here to testify in support of House Bill 2562. I have with me a farmer from here in Marion County, Doug Kramer, and he'll be able to tell you just a little bit about himself and what his thoughts are in just a moment. As you probably already know, the 1999 Oregon legislature passed a law, ORS 807, established certain restrictions on driver's licenses obtained by people under the age of 18 years of age. When a person under 18 acquires a license, they receive what's called a provisional driver's license now. This means that during the first year of acquiring the license holder must adhere to certain restrictions that are now under statute. And some of those are, for the first 6 months after issuance of the license, the holder of the license may not operate a motor vehicle that is carrying a passenger that is under the age of 20. And for the second 6 months, the holder of the license may not operate a motor vehicle that's carrying more than three passengers that are under the age of 20. The only exception to that is if the members, the only exception is if the young people are members of the holder's, the driver's license holder's immediate family. In addition, there's several other restrictions. I'll just mention that an additional restriction is that for the first year after issuance of the provisional driver's license, the holder of the license may not operate the motor vehicle between the hours of 12 midnight and 5 a.m. Perhaps some of you were involved in that piece of legislation when it was passed last go around. Now, in response to this law, the Farm Bureau saw some potential problems related to the law when it comes to young people working on the farm. So the Farm Bureau passed a policy just this last fall that states, we support legislation allowing drivers under 18 years of age to operate a vehicle with passengers under 20 years of age when operating a vehicle is necessary for agricultural employment. So what House Bill 2562 does is it proposes to relax part of the provisional driver's license law. Only that part that prohibits license holders from carrying passengers under the age of 20. House Bill 2562 does not propose to amend the part of the law that prohibits the holder of a provisional driver's license from operating the vehicle between the hours of 12 midnight and 5 a.m. And the reason for our proposal is this. Farmers hire many minor children for seasonal farm work. Seasonal jobs usually last between 2 and 3 months, and those time periods can match perfectly with school schedules. The seasonal work generally includes things like harvesting crops, moving machinery, mending fences, pulling rye, moving cattle, feeding cattle, and moving irrigation pipe. These are jobs that are generally performed by small groups of farm laborers, and commonly those people are between the ages of 16 and 18. Farmers are very dependent on the seasonal labor, and the minor children are very dependent on it as well for raising money to go to college and for extracurricular learning activities. In some of these rural areas, the activities provided by schools may be limited compared to some of the urban school districts, and the job market may be very, very tight, and the jobs just aren't available. I know from growing up in a very rural school myself, with a high school of only 50 people, most of the kids in our high school would work on farms within the area during the summer months, because in the town of Duford, the jobs were very limited. So the farmers are very dependent on these seasonal workers. And the likelihood of the drivers in these small farm labor groups only having provisional driver's licenses is quite high. And this makes it less efficient, maybe impossible for the workers to efficiently transport each other from job to job. And so it may make it less likely that the farmers could take advantage of these youth to work on the farms. So although the farming community really believes that the restrictions in ORS 807 are legitimate and a good idea for the safety of our kids, we do believe that the restrictions are less necessary when minors under the age of 18 are employed to perform work, when they're under employment. These kids that are under employment on the farms, they've accepted some of the most difficult jobs that exist, and we feel that they are responsible enough to transport each other from job to job. Many of these farm jobs are located perhaps miles away from the farm shop or headquarters. For example, there may be a group of young farm workers that need to pull rye over in this field that may be a mile away from the shop. Then they may be instructed to go mend some fence to keep the cattle in over a mile away in another field where the cattle are being grazed. Furthermore, the last point I'll make is that most of these drivers, these farm jobs where these young people are working and need to drive, most of them are occurring in more rural, remote areas rather than the urban areas. And in the urban areas, I think that that's where we see the traffic congestion, that's where we see the high-speed traffic, and that's where we see a lot of these accidents happening. In the rural areas, of course, those risks are decreased, although you know, they still exist at times. Now, with that, I'll say that I have communicated with DMV over this bill and with Kelly Taylor at DMV, and they don't, they have some problems with the bill. I don't see a DMV representative here. At least Kelly Taylor's not here. Maybe there's another DMV representative that I haven't communicated with over this. I would like to come to an agreement with DMV on this idea, if possible. So what I would suggest, if the chair would be so gracious to hold another hearing on this bill, I could get together with a DMV representative and talk about other options. For example, I was really thinking about this over the last few days. And under statute, there are many special driving privileges and permits that are given to various groups of people. For example, there's emergency driver's license that are given to very young people if it's deemed necessary. There are also hardship permits that are given to people who have been caught under the influence of alcohol while driving. And there are many other, there's a whole laundry list of certain driving privileges and permits that are given to certain groups. A lot of these special permits that are given out lay out exactly why the person needs the driving privileges and where that person will be driving and for what reason. So that if that person, that driver is stopped, the police officer can look on the computer and determine whether that driver is in the location that is described under the permit or is in violation of the permit. That is an idea that I've thought of that might work. I haven't communicated with DMV over on that idea. The potential problem that I see with that is that for these farmers that need seasonal help, they need to get their workers out there on the job immediately. Many times it's not the type of job that can wait, such as during harvest. And my understanding is that with these hardship permits, for example, sometimes they take a long time to be issued. It might be a couple weeks before those permits are issued. So if we came to some sort of resolution along those lines of a special permit, that if the farmer needed to employ a group of young people and the farmer knew that a provisional driver's license holder needed to transport those folks, then he could go into DMV and get a special driving privileges for that provisional driver's license holder. But it would need to be a simple type of permit that could be issued on a timely basis. So with that, I'll close my testimony, and I will hand it over to Doug to make a couple comments.
Yeah, after Gene's testimony, I don't have to make a lot, but I am...
Identify yourself for the record.
Okay, I'm Doug Kramer. I'm president of the Marion County Farm Bureau, and I'm a berry cut flower grower out of St. Paul, Oregon. Again, we, just to reiterate some of what Gene said, we do hire miners to... during the summer months to move irrigation and to operate our harvest equipment. Typically my farm, as well as many others, are not all located all in one parcel. We got parcels scattered sometimes over many counties,
And so there is a need for the employees to come to our location. That time we group them into vehicles and send them to the either to go move the irrigation, which they're moving on a frequent basis, or they move to the where the harvest machines are and where we're working that day, and in that case it's only going to and coming back each day. So there is a need for this. I understand some of the problems associated with it, but I guess that still doesn't change the fact that we need some relief in this area, however that may be worked out. And with that, I'd love to answer some questions if there is any.
Thank you both for your testimony. It is my intention to listen to the testimony today and allow for an opportunity for a meeting of the minds on this issue. My hope is that you'd run it through the governor's office as well. I don't have any desire to work on a bill that has a veto at the end of the line. I recognize the need, and it would be my intention to move something at some point. So that's where the chair is on this issue. We don't move this bill today. Are there any questions? Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you very much, Chair. Ms. Wilkinson, Mr. Chair, Ms. Wilkinson and Mr. Kramer, do you feel a need in this bill to restrict it to certain types of vehicles?
I guess what I would envision is if it was limited to the employer's vehicle, I'm not sure I'd have a problem with that. But as far as limiting the kind of vehicle, as long as it's the employer's vehicle, I'm not sure what more restrictions.
Follow-up, please. Mr. Chair, Mr. Kramer, different types of farm equipment, having been born on a farm and been married to a farmer, require different, special training to operate those vehicles. So I have a concern on this bill of giving a blanket. While I understand the need for this, and I understand that that you need to, get going, get your harvest done, but I'm a bit concerned about the allowing a blanket motor vehicle operational permit that allows them to operate pieces of equipment for which they've had no training.
I'd love to jump into that one. On this particular vehicle, I think we're only talking about vehicles licensed for the road and not our farm equipment. But I can guarantee you that there's no miner that's going to be running my $100,000 combine down the road without training, because believe me, I got a lot to lose. And whether it's a combine or a berry harvester or a pickup, safety is one of the things we are concerned about all the time, because the safer we can keep the farm, the lower our workers' comp rates and all the expenses associated with it. So training is a very important part of what we do, and those workers are trained every year when they come onto the farm. And if they don't show the ability to be able to handle our more expensive farm equipment, they're not allowed in it.
Representative Devlin.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Wilkinson, I was one of the sponsors of the original bill, and I can see sometimes the necessity of making some exceptions. I hope those exceptions, though, are made very carefully and don't result in any return to the unnecessary injuries or fatalities. One of the things about the way the bill is written that I think might be helpful in terms of discussions, and I've had no discussions with ODOT about this bill, is that the issue that was brought up before, that from home to place of employment, the bill might still apply, and then at place of employment going out to other locations, that would be the exception. It's unclear from the way the bill is written whether the additional youthful passengers in the vehicles would also have to be employees. That's not clear in the way that the bill is written, and I think that would be a necessity, or they could be immediate family members and have the exception that way. And the other thing would simply be that it more clearly define what is in the course of employment. You know, going from field to field is in the course of employment. Taking six kids out with you to go for lunch 10 miles away is not in the course of employment.
Chairman Starr, Representative Devlin, I'm writing down your ideas, and I'm appreciative of them, and maybe we could work with you and run some options by you to see what you think before another hearing occurs.
Thank you.
That was something that I was thinking as well. So if we can, Representative Devlin can work with Farm Bureau and ODOT and perhaps the governor's office to report on this. So Representative Donna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gene, when you talk to DMV and ODOT, I have a hang-up on the computer thing. Every time to make a change, it costs us $100,000 to $200,000. And if we can make that change without costing us more money, I would appreciate that. You'd look into that.
Thank you. Chairman Starr, Representative Zahner, I think ODOT, as we all do, really respect this new law and think it is and think it's wonderful. The statistics show that since this law has been put into place, the number of accidents with young people have declined, which is the result we were all hoping for in this law. I think that their concern might be that they don't want to start bringing in a lot of exceptions to the bill, which would undermine its intent. We feel that kids that are under employment and making narrow exceptions on that basis when it's needed isn't undermining the intent of the law. And I'll speak with them about financial issues, but I don't think that was their immediate concern.
President Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also echo Representative Devlin's comments in this regard on this bill. I generally support this idea. As a farmer, I can tell you the practicality issues of moving people from the shop in the morning out to the field. You're getting your equipment serviced in the morning and getting it ready to go for the day. It's an unbelievable hardship to not be able to put two or three kids in a service truck and send them out to the field and start the servicing, the blowing of the filters and greasing and oiling and all those things you got to do. Having said that, I recall as we debated this bill in transportation last session, that we did talk about potentials for these types of issues to arise. But I think generally we all felt that it was the worthy goal for us to make that change, and I think we've clearly seen the results have been very positive in terms of reduction in numbers of accidents and certainly the loss of life. So I want to see us go forward with this concept, but I think we need to be very careful about it and put the appropriate sideboards on it so it doesn't get abused. Because the last thing we need as an industry, if we're able to convince enough people in this building to do this as an exception for us, the last thing we need is some kind of an abuse to come out of this. So let's make sure that we put the appropriate sideboards on it, and then I think we will have made the right kind of tweak we need to make.
I appreciate your comments, and I appreciate your attention.
Mr. Chair?
That's enough.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Wilkerson, if I could just add one other concept. This is directly related to the exemption for farm, ranch, and orchard employees. And, you know, I come from wine country. And so I think there are other categories. So perhaps using agriculture and forestry would cover what we attempt to cover.
Chairman Starr, Representative Nelson, I will look at that, too, in looking at other options that I'll bring back to you.
Thank you both very much for your time.
Thank you. Can I just have one?
Yes, sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kramer, I just was curious, do you, in an employment situation this summer, generally require your employees to have driver's licenses? Is that
depends.
Feasible to make that a requirement given the nature of the work situation?
It all depends on what I'm hiring them to do, but typically, if an employee has a driver's license, they're paid a little bit more because they have the flexibility of being able to move not only the farm equipment, but also the licensed vehicles from farm to farm and move people from farm to farm. So, yeah, it's a requirement or it's a request, and they get paid additional monies per hour for being able to do that.
To follow up, Mr. Chair, do you think it's possible that there would be a way for you to work? I mean, I'm aware that you want modifications to this system, but a way to work with this system, too, so that it became an incentive for the people that you hire to actually get through the provisional period and get to that point where they're not restricted.
Yeah, I think I understand where you're headed with that. And the bottleneck for us comes when we have three or four of those employees with the provisional licenses, and we're not able to organize the work in such a way that we have a licensed driver that has already gone through that provisional period to drive the vehicles. So, and most of the seasonal workers we hire out of high school are in that 15 to 18 age range, and so the probability of having workers with those provisional licenses is pretty great at that point.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
All right. Director Salas from ODOT, manager, I believe, of the Traffic Safety Division.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
I'll have to take a couple more seconds than on Friday. My name is Troy Costales. I'm manager of Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And House Bill 2562 does ask to create an exemption for farmer, rancher, orchardist employees to the graduate driver licensing program. Currently, the restrictions are, was explained at the earlier testimony. As mentioned on Friday on a related bill, I commented to you about the current numbers that we're seeing in relationship to teen fatalities, which is the first thing that's coming forward to show the impact of how last session House Bill 2440 went into place. And on page 2 of the testimony is a chart just letting you know what has happened. And you note at the very beginning, 1994, there are 46 teens that were killed in motor vehicle crashes, and that had raised all the way up to 70, and that's what caught the attention of the legislature last session, to say there had been over a 50% increase in teen deaths. Since the implementation of the bill, you see in 1999 that number dropped to 37, and in 2000 that number dropped all the way to 29. Quite an impact, actually. The estimates of House Bill 2440 was only 10 to 12 fewer deaths, and there's been much more than that, than had higher impact than we had originally anticipated. For a new license holder, it takes time to learn how to operate a vehicle safely, and the graduate driver licensing just does just that. It allows them the time to acquire the ability to drive safely. Any exemption that's not specifically tied to either training or skill development has the potential of weakening the program and the process that was put in place last session. Majority of the Senate and the majority of the House members voted for this bill, 70% and 80% respectively. We are very encouraged by the initial information about what's happened, and this House Bill 2562 does create an exemption that strips away part of the life-saving measures that were supported by the last session. And just want to let you know we are concerned about any exemption that has the potential of leading to more crashes, more deaths, or more injuries.
Thank you very much for your testimony this morning. I appreciate it. And I would ask that you work with the representatives from the Oregon Farm Bureau and with Representative Devlin and seeing if there's a way that we can craft a limited exemption, because I believe there's a need for that. come in this situation, so I would ask that you work with them to see if that's possible.
The chairman would be glad to do that.
Thank you, Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we were to take the fatalities for 97-98, 130 fatalities, how many of those involved farm labor of the sort that's being considered in this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, I cannot answer that at this time. The database that captures the detailed information about fatal crashes does have vehicle type and licensing type in it, and that's something that we can check on. But I can't answer that right off the
top. I'd appreciate your taking a close look at that, because it'd be interesting to me certainly as to whether the contention that this bill would affect the number of accidents is accurate or not. That information would be useful in understanding it.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Chairman? Representative Devon?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In addition to Representative Merkley's request, if the information is available, can we get time of day for those?
That was my question.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony this morning, and I look forward to seeing some kind of product come back from the group and work on the bill. With that, I'll close. Actually, is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? And then I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2562. And I will open the public hearing on House Bill 2306. John, do you want to tell us about 2306?
Chair Stark, members of the committee, House Bill 2306 provides that an exception to open container law for certain commercial passenger vehicles, and only to passengers. Vehicles. There is no revenue impact on this bill, and there is no fiscal impact on this bill.
So my understanding is that this bill brings us into compliance with federal law, and currently that it's not unclear whether the drivers of a commercial vehicle can drink and drive. That's what I'm seeing here.
In essence, this bill will bring us in compliance with the Transportation Equity Act, in which there were tougher standards or sanctions that were passed in T21, and this will, based on the advisement of our Attorney General's office as well as United States Department of Transportation attorneys, they said that through administrative rules, which we've been utilizing since T21's passage, that they were weak, and therefore we need to toughen our laws. And so this law would bring us into compliance and applies passengers only in commercial vehicles. In terms of the driver of commercial vehicles, that is prohibited according to state law currently.
Troy Costello has signed up for testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Troy Casales, Manager of Transportation Safety Division from the Oregon Department of Transportation. House Bill 2306 expands the current open container law for the state of Oregon to cover drivers of vehicles for hire and publicly owned transit vehicles. Congress did place two sanctions on states in the impaired driving program area from T21. One sanction related to a set of penalties for repeat DUI offenders, and the other sanctions related to coverage, very specific coverage, for open containers. Oregon was not penalized for the open container provision due to administrative rules that were carried under ODOT's umbrella organizations. However, in doing the review and the back and forth between U.S. DOT lawyers and the Attorney General's office, they both mentioned that the administrative rules for Oregon barely get us by the sanction, and that they would question them again if nothing was done, because they did appear to be very weak. This bill places Oregon in better compliance with U.S. DOT and congressional actions by extending it, the open container law, to the drivers of vehicles such as taxis, limousines, buses, things like that. It also clears up some confusion currently for law enforcement, courts, and the drivers of these types of vehicles, not sure whether or not they fit under open container or not. and all of the interest groups that are involved in impaired driving agree that any access to an open container by any driver of a motor vehicle can lead to problems. And House Bill 2306 does close a gap in Oregon's law. I'd be happy to answer any questions best I can.
Mr. Chair, yes, thank you. On a public bus system, currently, are passengers allowed to consume alcohol?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berkeley, I cannot answer that specifically because I know there are some of the various entities that operate and own those transit systems have their own individual operating rules. If you were to just go by statute, this area of statute does not say that that alcohol cannot be consumed on the vehicle.
Mr. Chair, would this passage of this law change any local rules, affect any local rules that affect the consumption of alcohol by passengers on a public bus or a Greyhound bus or so on and so forth?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, the bill is just aimed at the drivers, that the drivers would not be able to have access or within reach an open container of alcohol. It exempts the passengers.
So the answer is no?
It would be no, I believe.
Any other questions for Mr. Consolis? I don't see any. Thank you, Troy, very much. Cindy Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cindy Roberts. I'm with the Oregon Transit Association. I understand the attempts this bill is trying to make, and it's a good one, to make sure that your drivers aren't drinking, whether it's a bus driver or someone you hire to carry you with a group to a casino. That's a good thing. However, I don't think most of the transit entities knew that right now passengers and drivers both could drink on the bus. And this is basically saying, okay, only the passengers can. We would actually like to see this take out motor vehicle operated by a publicly owned transit system so that the passengers on public transit can't drink, nor can the drivers. So we can see leaving the language on two, the offense described in the section does not apply to passengers in a motor vehicle operated by a common carrier, blah, 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 taking out the bus part because we'd rather not see our passengers drinking on the bus. So that's probably a work session issue for you guys, but my point here is that we understand we're for having the drivers kept from drinking, but we'd like to see the passengers kept from drinking too.
You're proposing an amendment that we amend the bill further to prohibit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on public transit. I understand on the common carrier because then you have people that you've hired to specifically take you somewhere. But for public transit, we'd like for no one to be able to have an open container.
Any questions for Representative?
Mr. Chairman, I think it would probably be worthy to ask Legislative Council if. Since the offense we're talking about is an open container law, I can understand you wanting to eliminate from a transit vehicle. My question is, are you seeking to simply have it possible to cite a passenger in a transit vehicle for a violation of open container law, or even if this law is changed this way, I don't think it would anyway bar, like TriMet, from prohibiting passengers from having an open container. They simply wouldn't be citable under this law, and they'd be citable under the transit authority's authority, actually.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, actually, you're right. Currently, the transit district itself can make laws having to do with this. And whether or not Legislative Council would tell you that this is already taken care of somewhere else in statute, I'm not sure. But the fact that there's this open hole right here that allows some transit agencies who actually have to work a lot harder to get any kind of transit agency rule, it takes a certain kind of vote, whether it's by constituents or by the board, to simply make sure that they don't have to deal with this problem with our goal.
Thank you.
Representative Donovan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you say transit, you're not including, like, the RAS buses that we go skiing up with, people drink on there. We can still do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Honor, actually, that's a common carrier under this law, so that would be okay. If it was a fixed route or some kind of public agency ride, like your dial-a-ride buses for a handicap, the Oregon Transit Association represents all the way from TriMet down to your dial-a-ride buses in the Coos Bay or some of the small areas that help you get the elderly around. It would affect all of them because they're public agencies, RAS Transportation, and those folks are not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Any other questions, Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. I did not get your name.
My name is Cindy Roberts.
Ms. Roberts, would this include rail?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I would think it would because it's a vehicle, public transit vehicle, but I'm not sure how that law works, to be honest with you. I'm not sure where the crossover is on definition of motor vehicles and rail, but I would assume technically rail is not a motor vehicle, but I would assume that some of the laws that currently apply on regular transit systems apply to rail as well. ODOT might be better at answering that for you. How about that?
Okay. Trying to get a nod, yes or no, from ODOT in the back of the room, but it does not affect rail.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps what we need to do is actually if the community administrator could check with Legislative Council and check with ODOT if we could still comply with the federal requirements by removing that language. And obviously, since it's more than just preparing a change in a number, we would need an LC amendment for it.
Anyone else wish to testify on House Bill 2306? Seeing none, close the public hearing on House Bill 2306. And we will work on both of these bills before we bring them back for work session. With that, committee's adjourned.
Yeah. 8:10 day today?
Apparently.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very interesting.